mentioned on the other day that the some of the if the colleges do this route where some people want to end this new thing and some don't, that what if somebody decides to change their mind? Is there going to be a essentially a piggy move up, move down, sort of a? Andrew, could you give me a little more volume coming my way, bud? Piggy move up and move down, which is kind of similar to what I believe they do in European soccer, and Mike's kind of a expert on that. So I thought maybe he could enlighten us, because you and I were kind of stumbling around on it Fridays how exactly that works, because I have a gazillion questions about how you all of a sudden move up and move down, or the stadium size is the same, what do you do with long-term contracts? I mean, there's got to be an incredible sort of a thing on that. But hey, I have a question for you. I mean, this is kind of...
Well, okay, ask it, because I have a question for you, too. So you fire away.
Well, should we wait? I want to talk a little bit about this Newt Rockne grave-moving thing.
I have no insight into that whatsoever.
Maybe we'll wait for a moment. It's an interesting story, because I didn't realize until I heard that they were moving... Newt Rockne was coach of Notre Dame, legendary coach. I don't know how many national championships he won. But it was back when college was kind of a lot different, and he went to he actually went to Notre Dame as a student, and is generally credited with inventing the forward pass, which most people don't necessarily.
Well, with incorporating it into college offenses.
No, actually, inventing how to do it. He, first of all, in those days, people went to college. You didn't bug out of high school like Kevin and I and most people and go right to college. He actually worked for the post office. I think he was 22 when he decided to go to college. So, you were men. It was a whole different... I mean, literally, a really good college team in those days was probably almost the same age as a pro team and probably could beat them. Not like today.
Oh, hell, a lot of their guys would go play pro games on Sundays after playing games on Saturday. They'd just play in a different name.
Yeah, I mean... The great story about George Gipp, and everybody's watching, win one for the Gipper and all that stuff, Newt Rockne, All-American. But George Gipp was, 23, 24, Kevin? And before the win one for the Gipper thing, George Gipp was one of the best players, I mean, basically in the country and everything. He kicked, he punted, he threw, he ran, did everything. And so they're losing at halftime, and Rockne starts giving this speech. And Gibbs says, "Knock it off, Rock. I got $100 on this game. I don't have to worry about me trying or something like that." But anyway, he and a guy named Gus Doré, I think Rockne was the end and Doré was the quarterback. They decided in those days the ball was shaped kind of different, so it was hard to throw. And you were coached to let the ball hit you in the chest and then wrap your arms around it. And they were the first guys to figure out if you reached out with your hands and caught it with your hands, you could do a lot better. So they didn't. You're right. They didn't invent the forward pass, but they essentially made it what it is today. But anyway, Rockne was a legendary coach there. He won all these titles, and I had one night. This is we talk about crazy story. Kevin, a few of us were coming back. I'd say from the library, but it was really from a bar, right? And we passed the circle, and there's a couple of girls there, and they started BSing with us. And one of the girls invites us. Says she's Rockne's granddaughter or something, and invites us for dinner the next night, like legitimately. Get her phone number. We go, and it was I thought Mike was one of them, but he says he wasn't. It was John Flynn and me and Mac and I think Dr. Blade. And so we go, and Kevin, are we in?
Welcome back, Stacks.
We're still on. Apparently, we're starting over.
We're kind of mixed here this morning.
Here's a problem. Andrew, we just have to keep talk over this because Andrew went out for coffee. He'll be right back. Anyway,
so we go to dinner, and the family is poor as church mice. You know, we have spaghetti for dinner. And I don't know if the young lady was... I think she might have had her giant eye on John Flynn, but she had enlisted in the Army and was going the next day. So it's the last time we ever saw him. We had a nice dinner. I had one uncle that was totally batty. Now he'd be institutionalized, but he's sitting there at dinner with us, just kind of talking away. But I mean, I'm talking about the poorest families I've ever come across. And so Rockne does. He was buried after this plane crash that the whole country was in. He was a big hero, and
plane crash, and he's buried at this Highland Cemetery. He was never buried at Notre Dame Cemetery. And I'm sitting there thinking, and the family had nothing good to say about Notre Dame. And I never could quite understand that. I mean, I never dug into it. I never quizzed them about it or anything. And so all of a sudden, the grave gets moved, and John Short sends me this thing and about how he's not got the new grave in the cemetery at Notre Dame. And evidently, anybody who graduates Notre Dame can get buried there if you want to. I mean, but his whole family is there now, Rackney's. So I started digging into him a little bit. You know, he was making a real lot of dough, Kevin.
Yeah.
I mean, a real lot of dough.
He was a big entrepreneur, doing a lot of, movies, instructional stuff, advertising, all of that kind of stuff. In fact, it was always a big thing at Notre Dame that people were worried that he was getting bigger than the university.
Well, they were paying him $10,000 a year. This is 1930. Now, I've got the median salary in 1929. Is guess how much, Kevin?
I don't know, probably about $2,000, something like that.
Roughly $30 a week.
Okay.
So what is that? $1,500. And at the year that he didn't die doing some philanthropic thing. He died going out to California to sign up for a movie. His last year coaching, he made $75,000. In 1931.
Yeah, that was Babe Ruth territory.
Yeah, but Columbia was trying to buy him from Notre Dame, and when Notre Dame found out about it, somehow Columbia nixed the deal. They were going to pay him $25,000 a year to come to Columbia. But I'm curious is how the hell if he had all that dough, how the family, how his sons didn't have a dime. I mean, $75,000 in the 1931 should have set you up for like a really long time. Unless it was in some bank that went under. That could have happened, I suppose, huh? You could just have been in a bank that closed, but maybe that's what happened.
Yep.
Anyway, kind of a crazy story. Just when you say, you wonder how people have money and don't, but I wonder how many other stories were there in those days, when the bank panic was not, 1932? Of how many people had $4,000, $5,000, and $10,000 in a bank that they'd saved their whole life for and it was just gone. I mean, obviously, all kinds of them, right? Look how many banks went out in Chicago. You could drive around the city and still see the old buildings, right?
Yep.
So anyway, your question.
Okay, so I have a question for you. This is a follow-up to your conversation with Hal yesterday, and it's not something that you've only said once. You've said this before when you said Trump didn't do anything. What do you mean by that?
You mean when he was in office?
In his presidency, yeah.
I mean, he wasn't able to accomplish any of the broad sweeping things that someone from the outside maybe should have done. He never touched the healthcare stuff.
USMCA.
But he didn't touch any of the prescription drug stuff. He didn't do any of that stuff. I mean, he didn't make a change.
But you said he didn't do anything.
He put through a tax decrease, which I think was horrible.
USMCA.
Go ahead, dig it. Tell everybody about that.
That's the trade agreement with United States Mexico Canada agreement.
Okay.
Negotiated that and got it ratified through Congress.
Okay, and I'm saying the parts that he was going to change, he really didn't change the bureaucracy.
That was one he was going to change.
Okay. Was that a big help?
Criminal justice reform.
How are we doing on that?
Bipartisan. Well, you know what? You still got to enforce the law locally. How about the opioid and sex trafficking legislation?
Did it do any good?
It did at the time, but since we decided that we would open the borders and allow for more sex trafficking information after he was gone, that kind of fell by the wayside. But they did pass that bill.
As you know, unfortunately.
How about the right to try law giving dying Americans access to experimental medications if they wanted them?
I would. There's areas that I can't focus on everything for some reason.
I know, but you said nothing. How about VA Choice Act?
Wait, what I'm saying is on the economic things that we look at on the show all the time that are the 24 and 25 and 30 year problems, none of those were addressed. In my opinion.
All right, VA Choice Act was a health care. Because if you remember, you couldn't get an appointment at the VA hospitals.
What do you mean you couldn't? You always could.
Yeah, you always could if you wanted to wait 90 days to get in.
Okay.
So the VA Choice Act said if you got a long wait, you can go choose your own doctor and still be covered by VA.
I don't think it helped any of the VA hospitals, did it?
It helped the veterans.
Okay. I didn't say there wasn't anything. What I'm saying is the stuff we talk about on the show.
Border control, Tom?
The stuff we talk about on the show.
Save first country and remain in Mexico?
All right.
Space Force? Let's see.
Did he do anything to make sure?
Federal sentencing reform. ISIS defeat. Initiated Department of Defense audits for the first time ever.
I can't imagine how those things went.
Enterprise zones.
There was no enterprise zone until he got there.
No, we had enterprise zone legislation that was built in, created all kinds of new enterprise zones. Let's see, CTE reauthorization since 2006.
I didn't say there wasn't a bill passed in 4 years.
Border spending, expanded short-term limited duration plans, deal with European Union increase in U.S. energy exports to Europe, revised trade agreement with South Korea, which included provisioning. He did promise that he would withdraw from the Paris Climate Accord.
Was that good?
Pacific Partnership.
Was that good?
And did. Abraham Accords, UAE, Bahrain, Sudan, Morocco.
He did all that personally.
Well, his administration did.
Well, none of this was Congress. They didn't pass a bill.
Congress passed the bills, the criminal justice reform, but that was initiated by Trump. Opioid and trafficking was initiated by the Trump administration, and Right to Try was initiated by
the Trump administration.
Those were bipartisan bills.
How about the one where he reversed Obama's ban on the experimentation that gave us COVID, and he reversed that just because it was Obama's?
That was wrong, but it was absolutely wrong. I'm not telling you it did everything right. A lot of people would say his tax bill was wrong. There are a lot of people who would say withdrawing from the Paris Climate Accords was wrong, but it ain't nothing.
It's stunning.
It was a promise during the campaign that was capped.
What happened to the promises regarding the medical care that he erased from his?
Obviously, didn't deliver on them. But that's, you said nothing. You said nothing.
Okay, nothing is an interesting word.
Yes, it is.
Did he do something?
That's why I'm clarifying.
Okay. Anything we talk about on this show that we think needs to be changed economically and socially going forward, he didn't touch. He increased the deficit incredibly with the tax bill. You can trace the deficit we have in this country, you can trace it back to Ronald Reagan, cutting taxes and then just saying, well, we'll see where it all lands. And I don't want.
I understand that, Tom.
Okay, but
he said he didn't do anything.
In that context,
you said that many times.
In that context, I was talking about the several subjects that Hal and I have been talking about for years, in terms of deficits, in terms of those kinds of things, in terms of medical policy, in terms of Social Security, any of those kinds of things that Republicans don't usually touch. He didn't touch.
Well, I think the context of this was you said he got into the White House on day one, started complaining about media, and
which he did.
That was all he did, and then he didn't do anything.
Which he did, complain about media the whole way.
Yeah, he did. Well, you might, too, if they were claiming that you were colluding with Russia when you knew you weren't, and that they very uncuriously didn't pursue the story, just repeated what they had been told that was originally.
Here's where I have an issue with... this election, Kevin. I understand, and I have people very close to me, I understand an awful lot of people don't want to vote for Kamala Harris, and we could have a huge show on what I don't like about Kamala Harris, okay? But I think we've seen enough of Trump in his 70-some years to know just what the man is, all right? So just because you don't like her, or just because you don't like him, doesn't make her terrific or him terrific. They are what they are.
Mm-hmm.
They are what they are.
Now, you are also very prone to saying all he does is complain about this person and insult that person.
Which he does. I've never heard anybody at that level ever do that.
All, Tom.
What?
Because he has been doing town hall meetings at least once a week. He's got another one today that's televised just for women. It's a women's town hall, so he's just going to discuss.
How many times is he going to say she's dumb or stupid?
I don't know.
Well, that is
how you're also. You know, he's been doing a podcast every week, you know, aimed at younger people. So, for instance, most recently, he did the Flagrant podcast. That's with Andrew Schultz and spent an hour and a half.
When did I say he wasn't campaigning?
Just shooting the breeze with these guys. So we did that.
Have you listened to any of them?
He's been doing sit-down interviews, most recently last weekend with Maria Bartiromo, but he's been doing that, and those aren't all sitting there doing insults. So, you know, have you watched any of those?
Yes. I watch about 5 minutes, and when he starts insulting people, I turn it off.
5 minutes of what? The rallies? Or
the rallies. As soon as I walk into my girlfriend's house, there's a rally on, and I can't even stand it.
Have you watched any of the sit-down interviews?
Why would I possibly go further and watch him? I don't watch Kamala all day long either. I have a job. I mean,
got weekend time. You could watch the Maria Bartiromo in the morning.
You're not going to talk me into thinking Trump's a savior. I know what the man is.
No, I'm just saying you have a very binary position that isn't allowing for that allows you to say some things that simply aren't true.
My binary position allows me to say the serious issues that we talk about on the show, the economic issues, which is what the show is mostly about. He didn't do any of that stuff. Does it mean he didn't pass a bill or didn't help Egypt and Israel cause? You know, do their peace agreement or whatever they did. Yeah, but it wasn't a totally unaccomplished 4 years. And I've also said his administration got jumped by COVID, just like Bush's got jumped by 9/11.
He probably got jumped at least as bad, if not worse, by that whole 2.5 years of Russia investigation that kept their hands at least partially tied behind their back.
Kevin,
And it turned out to be complete BS.
It was not complete BS. They have an investigation because the man had a massive business dealings with a country that's a problem with us.
Tom, where did the investigation start? Where did it start with the FBI?
It started with him. Was he talking to Putin? He's doing something, wasn't he?
No, it started with the Clinton administration.
Yeah, okay.
The Clinton campaign. And colluding with the FBI to start an investigation that didn't have any basis in fact. This is all documented. This is not
so. The Russians
this
didn't.
Is true.
The Russians.
This is all public record.
I think he's the world's greatest American. If we don't have him, what are we gonna do without him?
Yeah, let's jump there because that's exactly what I'm saying, and you're paraphrasing me perfectly.
The man has had all kinds of ties with Russian oligarchs and so forth, going back to them bailing out his condominium by the the UN.
Was that public information?
Yeah, pretty much.
Okay, so why did we need to investigate what was already public information?
Kevin, I don't know why they investigated.
Why did we need to create a collusion investigation out of public information?
Kevin,
we all already knew.
Why are you on me about it? Yesterday saying I don't know why the hell the investigators were all over Elliot Spitzer. I have said 100 times on this show that this constant whatever Trump may have done, and I think he's a sleazebag, but whatever he may have done, nobody in this country deserves a $40 million legal bill from our country. I've said that 100 times. There's no excuse for what they've done to him or other people. None whatsoever. But the allegations, and who are all these allegations? The allegations were that the Russians were somehow involved putting money in the election. Now, whether they didn't like the Clintons, whether they didn't, whatever, it wouldn't surprise me at all if the Russians are messing around in our election. Now, when you look at his background with the people in Russia, the question is, was there some truth to that? I think I don't know. I don't know if there was or there wasn't. I know that he had more ties to them than most people do. Now, did that mean that when it came to politics, he listened to them? I don't hope not. I don't think so. But I mean, it wasn't like there was no reason. The guy had never talked to a Russian in his life. Now, is that enough to do an investigation on somebody? I agree with you. No.
So it's good. I'm glad you do, because that was kind of a substantial factor in A, the news coverage that he had, and B, the ability to operate.
How long do we wait in the Clinton administration because he got oral sex with one of his interns? How many years did that?
That is not what he got impeached for.
Okay.
He did not get impeached for getting a BJ in the Oval Office. He was impeached for lying under oath in his deposition, which denied, I think, was it Kathleen Willey or was somebody else, denied her, it was a big factor in denying her the ability to go forward with a sexual harassment suit.
I think we should...
He denied a woman her day in court, basically.
I think we should impeach every politician who lies. Oh, my God.
Lie under oath in a deposition? That's going to get you in trouble. In fact, he did lose his law license over that, and he did, in fact, have to pay a hefty fine for that.
All right. Okay.
So you could argue yes or no whether he should have been impeached over it, but at least the state bar in Arkansas saw it a little bit differently.
It's very difficult when somebody shoots off the hip and says a lot of crazy stuff, like Trump does, to try and cut away the truth from whatever. I mean, to not think now the allegations appear to be that he's talked to Putin 6 times since he left office.
Yeah. Do you think the reporting on him has been accurate enough for you to just completely buy into that, even though it's anonymously sourced.
Let me ask you the question: why? And this is the part I don't get with the guy. Everybody else immediately assumes it's biased and he didn't do it. I don't know whether he did or he didn't, but on one side people assume that he did, and on the other side people assume they don't. That's not healthy, Kevin.
I don't assume anything about what he did or didn't do, but I do question the source. And I question the timing, and how many times Cheryl Atkinson used to keep a running list of all the reports about Trump that proved to be untrue? It was up to like 170.
And how many reports on other people the same way? Then none of this stuff is right. Every article I've ever read on anything to Eddie Johnson being drunk has never been accurate, Kevin. That we knew something about. You and I both know that. But now the question is, why? I don't necessarily believe it. I question the source as well, but I wouldn't put it past him, because he certainly doesn't seem to think the laws apply to him.
That's a personal bias for a story that is not well sourced and is reported. It's not dual sourced. It's not corroborated in any way. And so that's your personal biases. You wouldn't put it past them. Okay, you're welcome to it. Just
okay, but you're
fess up to that's what it is.
I have my weaknesses, and once in a while I'll generalize, maybe like I did yesterday, and you called me out on it. Well, I can do the same to you. Your idea of just not well sourced means I don't believe a word of it.
No, that's not it. I want to see somebody on the record. I want to hear. I want to have corroboration, ideally, because that's usually the standard in journalism, is multiple sources.
Do you think for a second, what you know about the man, that if he had the opportunity to talk to Putin, he would say, that's against the law, I won't do it?
What are you talking about?
Trump.
Oh, okay.
You think he believes the laws apply to him? Any of these people, a lot of these people don't seem to think it applies to them.
Well, clearly not, because it happens all the time.
Well, the Clinton sure didn't.
Is there any reason why? Was he conducting foreign policy? Did they accuse him of undermining foreign policy?
The Clinton's the same
way.
Or did
they talk to Putin? And so I don't even know. But let's just say.
What do you think they talked about? Dinner the night before?
You're talking about you wouldn't put it past him And the real argument is, did it happen in the first place?
I am just as after the Clintons for having the foundation where they accepted foreign money, which went into a campaign. That's a campaign law that they broke. I mean, I'm saying we're reaching a point here where, Kevin, where seemingly all these people don't think they're above the law they're supposed to be pushing on other people.
Yeah, I won't argue with you about that. I won't argue with you about that. But I will suggest that we really ought to have some journalistic standards, and clearly we don't, and you saw that during the whole Russia collusion thing more than you would ever imagine.
You saw it during the COVID nonsense
that they just take whatever somebody says and they go ahead and publish it.
And the stuff from the right is the same way.
Yeah, okay.
But you can't just assume.
So does that make the
by the way, I think this
report about Putin any more credible or less credible?
I think the report about Putin came from Bob Woodward.
Okay.
Right. I mean, well, at least I know. Bob,
you know, he repeated it. He didn't. What's the source?
Okay. Now, does that mean it's wrong?
No, but it doesn't mean it's right either.
But every other allegation on Harris, that's all immediately right.
No, did I say that?
But I mean, that's that.
Did I say the allegations that are out in the public domain about Tim Walz and child molestation? Did I say those?
They're
right?
They're very effective, aren't they?
Bring that up.
They're very effective, aren't they?
Well, they may be, but I'm not on that bandwagon. You're gonna have to. Somebody's gonna.
Well,
have
why
to
don't
give
we go to
proof.
Break and hopefully Mike will call in and we'll talk about this how the European soccer leagues are set up, because I have a lot of questions on that if he's around. S&P futures up 475. NASDAQ futures up 38. Looks like we're heading south, north today, at least so far. Be right back, Stocks and Jacks.
Hello, this is Tom Howe, the Chief. I think most of you know that I'm also the Chief Investment Officer at PTI Securities and Futures. There we invest for and help a wide variety of clients. And you know what? No two are the same. Some have legacy stocks, some concentration issues, some maybe embedded tax issues. The others might need or want some portfolio protection. There could be estate issues or maybe new family members. The point is that we are all unique and the portfolios should match. However, the last several years have seen a relatively one-way market. It seemed that all we needed was to be all in. No protection, no fixed income, just be all in, no matter who you are, what your risk profile or age. Most management firms love that. Take this and like it, no matter who you are. Be careful with that. You are not everybody. I think most see the market view going forward as maybe different than the one looking back, so your portfolio should reflect that. Maybe it's just as simple as your life station has changed. Towards that end, we are accepting some new clients needing a more personal approach and are interested in negotiating the future and not with a portfolio designed for the past. Find me at 312-663-4310. That's 312-663-4310. Hello, this is Tom Howell, the Chief. Confused about investing these days? I suspect you are not alone. Investing was never easy, although at times it may have seemed so. I think one reason behind the current concern, although maybe not explained as such, is how the fluctuation in the American dollar and the associated politics is affecting your investments and your wealth. It may not be enough to make some money in your investments. You may need now to make enough to exceed the amount that your leadership is depreciating the value of the dollars you've worked your whole life to accumulate. That same leadership has seen fit to maneuver risk-free interest rates to near zero. Providing positive risk-averse returns in a zero-interest and declining real wealth environment is by far the toughest assignment I've ever had in my years as a money manager. I'm sure that a lot of you have heard that one way to possibly deal with this problem is to invest in so-called hard currencies like silver and gold, the idea being that they will retain their relative value in the face of devaluation of paper currencies like the dollar. To be honest, I have never been a gold bug. I've always had faith that having enough dollars and a good investment strategy was good enough. Now I'm not so sure. But I do know that if I did invest in gold or silver, I'd want to do it in the same manner as we do at PTI for investments in the market, with defined risk. If you feel the need to invest in gold or silver, we can do it using the same strategies that we use for our protected index program. No matter what you invest in, we feel that you need to know and control your risk. Find us at PTISecurities.com. That's PTISecurities.com.
Stocks, jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
You are out of control.
Right here. Right now. Right
here, right now, right now. Well, welcome back to Stocks and Jacks. I'm Tom Howell. We got Andrew on the board. S&P futures up 550. NASDAQ futures up 40. I don't know. Do we think Kevin's part of the innovation economy? I don't know. We'll have to talk about that, too. I didn't even know there was such a thing, but I guess there is. Over in Europe, we have the... It's kind of odd here. We've got the DAX down 44, but FTSE's up 59.7. CAC's down 39, so a very mixed bag there. Most of the markets over there are lower except for the FTSE. Over in Asia, boy, talking about rack 'em and sack 'em Asia. Nikkei is down 7.30 today. It's 1.8%. 39,180. Hang Seng down 31. That's pretty flat. Shanghai up 1 after the big move up yesterday. So I don't know what it's like to trade this Nikkei market. I mean, it's 2% each day. It's got to be crazy. Yesterday, Dow was down to 324. Most of that was United Health. It was down $50. That's like $350, like right there. The multiplier is like 7. S&P futures are down 40. S&P was down 44. NASDAQ down 187. The bonds today are down 3 basis points, but still 10-year over 4, 4.006, so barely over 4. The Bund down 4 basis points, 2.18. Japantown 2 basis points, 0.95. So just when you thought we're going to go flying over 4%, we've kind of come back the other way a little bit, which is, I don't know, just kind of curious. I won't say strange. Oil down 19 cents, 70.39. Brent down 23 cents, 74.02. Natural gas down 2 cents, 247. Gold up $15, 26.94. Wow, knocking at the door at 2,700. Silver up 29 cents, 32.05. Copper up 4 cents, 438. We're still long in the gold and stuff, but God, I wish I was a little longer. Always wish you're a little longer when it goes up, eh? Euro under 109, 108.90. So the dollar still stays a little strong. The pound 130, and the Japanese 149. So the Japanese continues to get weaker. And we have Bitcoin up a $1,300, 68,199. That's incredible. Andrew, what do you got for us? Traffic, weather, sports.
All right, it is 6:40 here in Chicago, and October 16th. Just a little bit of sports here. The Blackhawks played and lost against the Flames last night, and in their game, 1-3. But over to Chicago weather, it is currently 38 degrees right now. It's going to warm up a little bit throughout the day. We're going to have a high of 57, but we're going to stick pretty cool throughout the day. A little bit of sun, a little bit of clouds all throughout. Not as bad as yesterday, at least with the rain. But over in Phoenix, they are a lot warmer. They are currently at 69 degrees. They're going to have a high of 98. And moving on finally to that Chicago traffic, it looks like thankfully no major accidents to report. Traffic is heavy on the inbound expressways, but let's see if things pick up a little bit more on the second hour. That is all I got. Back to you.
Yeah, so Kevin, as we talk once in a while, when we're not talking politics, about the markets, when we have Mike, let me know, Andrew. Yesterday morning, I was mentioning a little bit about how oil had this big dump down, right? It's been running up, and it's been running up sort of attributing to the, what was Israel going to do to Iran, and a lot of people were calling for messing with their oil facilities and so forth. Well, all of a sudden, we come in yesterday, and oil is down $2.50, which is kind of a lot. And sure enough, an hour later, the news comes out that in a conversation between Biden and Netanyahu, Netanyahu essentially promised to not take out the oil facilities. Now, I'm going to say I didn't get that memo, Kevin. Did you?
You didn't get the memo about the promise?
Yeah, or when that's what Biden was going to ask for, or I don't know if he did ask, or whether somewhere or another, one side knew that was part of the conversation, and there was some serious leakage. Again.
Yeah, although it's not a very surprising thing. I think the last thing that the Biden administration is kind of a mixed bag of what they are and are not doing for VP Harris, but I would think that they would definitely not want any big run up in price before the election. So it doesn't really surprise me that they've made the request. It may surprise me a little bit that Netanyahu is honoring it, although I suppose he can just go after their oil facilities anytime he feels like it. So maybe it's just not that big a deal. I think it's a development. I don't think it's a big surprise of a development.
One of the interesting comments. I remember this. I can't believe I remember this stuff from so long ago. But I remember somebody asking. It was interesting having a class with Milton Friedman because he was teaching a class that nobody wanted any part of, including him. I think it was the economics of supply, Kevin. You'd have been the only person that loved this class, right? Although I don't know if you'd have liked all the calculus and all the graphs. Every graph had like 15 lines on it, right? You had no idea what that was.
I'd like it now because, you know, Mr. Excel and Mr. Computer Modeling Software would do a fine job with it.
Actually, I think it was the Theory of Price was the name of the class. It was a two-quarter class. And the book was a manuscript. I think I still have it, written by Milton Friedman. And he was so bored with it, he didn't finish the manuscript and make it a book. So it was still a manuscript. It's like, okay, then. But, of course, everybody knocked him off topic whenever. And they asked him about insider trading. And now, you have to put everything in context, right? In those days, everybody, when you made a trade with somebody, you made the trade face-to-face. Okay, so he said, they're always going to be ahead of you. The SEC is useless. They're never going to go after the people that actually do it because they're going to like those people. Just let everybody do whatever they want to do. And by the way, the market, you know, he was a big free market guy. He was very much like Hal. That over a period of time, when people walked in the IBM crowd 5 minutes before the earnings every single time, you might get away with it the first time. The second time, people won't trade with you. Third time, you might get a bloody nose. And he said, just let the market. Now, in the world of electronic trading, where everything is blind, and you've got 17 different exchanges, and you can hide all this stuff, I don't know that he would have made the same answer. I'm guessing he wouldn't have. But his point was, you know, he would say, you know, kind of let this slide. But that doesn't mean that if Netanyahu or somebody in the Biden White House, before this is public, calls one of their buddies at Goldman Sachs or someplace, that that's not wrong. You know, let it get out on its normal time. But I guess his feeling was you were never going to stop that. And if the oil pit was an open outcry pit, and you knew Netanyahu was talking to Biden, and the Goldman guy comes running in there to sell oil, you knew enough to stay away from him. Would be his way of doing it. But today's world, I don't know how you police that, if you want to. And I think they only want to police it against certain people. Just saying.
Well, yeah, because we are in an age now where, you know, instant information, instant access to information, is... We rely on it, actually, is probably the best way I can put it. And so when somebody has information that nobody else does, it puts you in an interesting situation because as soon as it becomes public, then it's ubiquitous. You know, how long does it take it to travel around the world? Oh, about 4 seconds. So, you know, it's an incredible advantage to have it ahead of time, even if it's 10 minutes ahead of time. Just because of because of what information technology does. So yes, it's a totally unfair advantage.
You've heard this story. I don't know if some of the new listeners maybe have not. Way back in the day. I mean, we're talking long, long time ago. It was probably during the 80s. When was Reagan in? Was
80s? Yeah, you know, 80 election.
80 to 88.
So 81 to the beginning of 89?
Somewhere, yeah. So I just moved up north. I'm driving to take my mom to breakfast, and they've got one of those things on Saturday morning. And it was those news shows that nobody listens to because who the hell's up at 6:30 on a Saturday morning? And it was George Shultz. He just croaked, didn't he? Like 103 or something? But he was Reagan's Secretary of Treasury and Secretary of State, wasn't he? He's a really brilliant guy. I mean, he was the guy that gave us George Bush, you know, the second George Bush.
Yeah, the gift that keeps on giving.
Yeah, the gift that keeps on giving. He hated Clinton. Anyway, that's another whole story. But one of the guys asked him, you know, people used to ask questions, as, like you and I maybe would, Kevin. He said, Secretary Shultz, when you got to be head of the Treasury and all these numbers come out, who gets that information before the number hits the street? And he goes, instead of saying, oh, God, nobody, you know, like they would today, he goes, funny, you should ask that. He goes, when I first got there, I asked the same question of my mavens or whatever the guys underneath me are. Somebody gives me this list of people. He goes, I couldn't believe. He goes, obviously, the president, you don't want the president walking out to the helicopter and say, what'd you think of the labor report? And him say, what labor report? Right? You can't do that. You and I think, get that, right? I was hoping Dutch wasn't going to trade on it, but I don't know if I trust the people today. But he says, I couldn't believe the names on this list. So the first thing I did was start saying, this guy doesn't get it, this guy doesn't get it. It was the hardest thing politically I ever did. Finally, I gave up. I remember that conversation word for word like it was yesterday, Kevin. To this day, I wonder, I can't believe he said that, and I'll bet it's the same way. He goes, these people got no business on this list.
Well, the difference being that they don't, instead of having to give up, they don't even try now.
Yeah, he says, I gave up. And it was you know, the power is the bear. What do you mean you're taking me off that list? Who the hell do you think you are? Well, I'm Secretary of the Treasury, dog. Evidently, it didn't work. I mean, I don't know if Reagan didn't back him up or he didn't want to bother Reagan with it or something, but he said, I gave up.
Not surprising. You know, connected to the government is the key to success now. It is locally, it is nationally, it is, you know, whatever you want to do. It just depends on the size of your business. And, you know, when I say business, I include all kinds of non-government, not-for-profits or... and so on, that it, as long as you're connected. And this is, you know, this will go right down to the city of Chicago.
Oh, yeah.
It'll go right down to, I don't know, the village of Glenview. It doesn't matter. Whoever's connected is going to get the business.
Well,
I saw that, if you remember our little revolution that we staged here in Southwest Michigan in our township. You know, it was who was connected. And it, you know, that whole deal that we were working to, that got us to ultimately throw out most of the board in a recall election, just stunk. Even though there was no hard evidence, no cash trail, I mean, it just stunk. It's one of those things where you know there's corruption and you can smell it, you just can't necessarily prove it.
Well, that's when these economic definitions, Kevin, when you... There's so many nuances to it. I mean, I know when I talk to people, well, usually it comes from people from the right, but it doesn't have to, and this is not a slam. If people will talk at like, say, Harris or anybody like that, I mean, they'll say, they're a bunch of socialists. And I go, they're not my idea or your idea of the economy we have now is not the free market economy that you and I and Hal and most people think we should strive for, right? But it's also not socialist. It's some hodgepodge in the middle. Socialism, you know, you and I and everybody could go, we don't have land rushes anymore, but if we had 100 people that said, okay, we're all going to run out there and we're all going to grab however many acres we can, and what we're going to do is we're going to pool our wheat, we're going to pool something, we're going to put some sort of a socialist economic system together. It doesn't mean that there's not going to be law and order. It's just going to be a different system. But it's not anywhere near what we have now. I mean, the socialism that people accuse Harris and a lot of the Democrats and even some of the Republicans, it's not by any definition socialism. It's something. I mean, it's probably closer
to...
Well,
some of it is, I think, by... And I'll come back to this, but some of it is by, you know, by the most common understanding that we have of socialism. A lot of it is the European, you know, democratic socialist type of model, which is a little bit different. And frankly, it's interesting that it's so widely embraced nowadays... from the left anyway, when so many European countries are moving away from it.
Well, I think there's
which is kind of interesting. You know, your Swedens and people like that who were really into it.
But I'm saying,
a little bit that, you know, that's you know, we're splitting hairs over what it means. But what's not socialist about an EV mandate?
What I'm saying is. The economic system that we have now, that I'm not talking. Let me split hairs a little bit, but the idea what we have with three or four companies and a lot of industries
buying up other people with their nose so far up the ass of government they can't smell or they can't breathe. That's fascist. That's not socialism. That's not capitalism.
I understand, and I agree with you. I agree with you 100% on that.
But Roosevelt started this. His presidency started this. Now, whether it was his idea or not, who the hell knows? But the idea that everybody in America needs some sort of a safety net. And his idea, Social Security, was what, $30 a month or something? That someplace somewhere in America, if somebody's in trouble, we're going to have some sort of a minimal safety net. That by definition is not socialistic at all. That's a safety net. That doesn't mean, I mean, if it may be a little bit more socialism than if he doesn't have any money, let him starve. But it's not really a socialism economic system. It's a safety net. And I think there's a difference.
Yeah, and there are people who would believe that is socialism, and that Social Security may be the same thing. You know, I don't care. I think we've kind of gotten to the point in this country where we've accepted some of those aspects of it, whatever you want to call it. Those aren't even really debatable items anymore. They don't get debated. So, it's really what does look more like, the heavier-handed socialism. And I think a lot of the mandates that we want to put into place, those are starting to smack more of the hardline socialist model. To tell me that not only should we buy electronic vehicles as an example, not only are we going to subsidize those, but we're going to require a certain percentage of them to be all that's made by 2030, 2035. That to me is getting into central planning.
Oh, I'm with you. Yet, and some stuff, Kevin, I don't know, and it's really hard to split this off, okay? Because and I don't know, I think if you keep it to an absolute minimum, but then my idea of a minimum, scary as it may seem, as much as you and I argue, an economic stuff like this, I think we're pretty much on the same page. I mean, I don't think that an individual company could have built Hoover Dam. I don't think an individual company could have bought up all the land in Tennessee and did the Tennessee Valley Authority. There's some things that government, other than just the military, seems to have to do. Now, if they organize it in such a way where it's a legitimate bidding process and so forth, and individual companies do bits and pieces of it under the proper bidding and so forth in a very capitalist system, free market system, I don't have a problem with it. Do you? I mean, I don't have a problem with a toll road if there's actually a bidding system where you go out and say, okay, well, now we don't man the toll booths for whatever stupid reason. But if we're going to have 50 workers or 100 workers in these toll booths, why can't we have a legitimate bidding process for doing it? But it's never legit, is it? It appears, or very seldom. So I mean, it's not like we couldn't do this if we wanted to. I mean, the genius of Chicago politics, and I'm sure we're not the only ones, but the genius of, I'm going to say, the Daleys and people like that, if you looked at Mayor Daley and said, this guy doesn't look like a gazillionaire, and he wasn't. Yet, Mayor Daley had an awful lot of money in other people's pockets, and he knew that. I mean, I'm not saying anything that anybody doesn't know, the system doesn't know. If all of a sudden the bid for the Dan Ryan fix, the legitimate bid is $1,000 a foot, and all of a sudden it comes out of $1,200 a foot, there's $200 in play, right, Kevin?
Okay.
And I mean, this is pure economics. I mean, there's $200 in play, because, and now if you call that guy up and you say, gee, Kevin O'Neill's great granddaughter, if you had one, is running for judge, she could sure use a bunch of tickets. Guess what? That guy pays it, right? Because the extra money, he knows he's got extra. Now, what George Stigler used to say, if the bidding process was absolutely perfect, and the profit is whatever the profit ought to be, 10%, 12%, 8%, I mean, it shouldn't be 100%. I mean, everybody knows how much you're buying a concrete, you're buying a steel. But whatever it is in that sort of business,
if that's all the guy made, and Mayor Daley called him up, he's going to say, I got no dough. I made just the right amount. There's no extra here. But that never happens, does it? There's always a little extra.
It doesn't seem to, because, yeah, that's where you get into, you know, what's the level of corruption involved in it. And that's, you know, it's an item that should be on the table for discussion.
Well, I'll give you a
because it's not competitive. But yeah, I don't think there's a lot of people that argue that government has no role in an economy. The question is where do you draw the line?
Right.
And you know, you or I might draw it one place. Hal's going to draw it someplace else. And you know, my line is really, you know, is it important enough that it won't happen if government doesn't take the initiative, and it's important enough to make sure it happens. That's where you get the government involvement there. And then your mission after that is to see if you can't make it as competitive as possible within that construct.
I'll give you I try, and I know it's hard to understand, and people don't, unless you're goofy about economics than I am. And that's why when I said the Trump administration did nothing, I was really meaning, Kevin, all the stuff that I care about on the economic side. I mean, I should have been a little more straightforward in saying that the man didn't sit there for 4 years and do absolutely nothing, because that's obviously what you pointed out is not the truth. But when I came to the trading floor, I was trading in a crowd, and if you wanted to do a spread in another crowd, I'd give it to the broker in IBM, or I'd give it to, you know, Audrey was in the crowd, I'd give it to her or somebody else. And I paid, the going rate was $1 a contract for brokers, right? You know, people look today, man, oh man, I don't pay it. Well, okay, that's what we paid. Now, that was the, quote, list price. Yet in the CBOE, everybody knew that if you did over a couple $100 with a guy, a broker, you took 30% off. Everybody knew that. Okay, so I'd get a bill from somebody, $1,000, I'd pay him $700, and everybody was happy. And because you went up and asked him, what's the discount? He'd say 30%. And the CBOT in the Chicago Mercantile Exchange, it was absolutely verboten for somebody to discount the dollar. So, but the market rate was what? 70 cents, right? As I just explained. So what do you think happened with the other 30 cents? There was all kinds of phone clerks getting kickbacks. There was even allegations of the mob was involved in the Euro Dollar Pit over in the Merck, that they put some guys in there because they knew all the kickbacks were coming. They had, you know, some of you got to hire this guy as your clerk.
They wanted their tribute.
Yeah. So, but it all was because the price was $1 instead of 30 cents. This, you know, I know people listen to the show, and sometimes they go too far into the economic principles. Whenever something is going for more than what the price ought to be, there's a finger in the pie. And you know, it's just like Johnson's war on poverty. If you took the money they spent, divided by the amount of poor people, and sent them a check, you wouldn't have any poverty. Now, people think there's a moral hazard to that, and I happen to agree. But the simple fact is, having people steal it all along the way doesn't help you, does it?
Well, that's the argument for reparations, isn't it?
Yeah, but I mean,
we just give everybody the money, and they'll all be fine.
I'm more than willing to give everybody money for reparations on slavery if I also give a check to everybody in the Union Army who died or lost a leg or an arm.
Well, you could have that argument. You could also have the argument that, you know, how does a legal settlement work?
Plus, how do we even...
Answer that question. How does a legal settlement work?
Well, I have no idea on that. God.
Well, you sign an agreement, and we're done.
To who? Who do you sign it to?
Well, if you get, you know, let's just say you and I have a dispute, and we have a lawsuit, and then we decide to settle out of court. And then we sign an agreement. We say you're probably the one at fault, so we'll make it you paying me. You're going to write me. You're going to send me a check for X, and then we're done. We walk away. We don't owe you don't owe me anything anymore. If you want to do reparations, does that mean the end of all? You give everybody enough. Here's enough money. You can go to college. You can start a business. You can do whatever it is to be successful. So here's everything you could possibly, here's enough money to make sure that you can have a good life because you were disadvantaged by the long-term effects of slavery. Now we're done. No more social programs related to...
How are you going to do that?
Related to preferences. Do you think that would fly?
No, I mean, I was just going to ask you, what if Evanston, which is close to this, sends out a check to every African-American? Now, if that person moves to Salt Lake City and they do the same thing, do they get another check?
Probably. they probably do. And so, yeah, there would be a whole new industry. Heck, you set up a moving agency to help people move to wherever the next check's coming from.
Well,
you'd probably make some good money doing that.
I was talking to one of my... Carl, if you're on...
The point is that if you're gonna do a settlement of a grievance, isn't that how it works? Then we're done.
No more
preferences of any kind.
Well, let me give you a real quick story. And it's, again, one of my strengths and weaknesses, I think everything applies to everything else. I was talking to one of my friends last night who was one of the original people to put together one of these marijuana places. And when they did it, we're talking 7-8 years ago, and I think it was a $45,000 non-refundable deposit, and probably a 50-100-page application. And some people were just bleep out of luck, but these guys got one up on the north side. And actually, there was a couple places, Kevin and Carl, that if you would have applied like for Kankakee. Nobody applied there. If you would apply there, you had to get one. So, but there were places they didn't tell you. So three people applied for like downtown Chicago, and one person got it. The other two just forfeited their like their 50. Where if they would have applied for Kankakee, they would absolutely have got it because they were the only one. It was really screwed up. So then,
so Russell didn't apply. Russell, didn't you apply for Kankakee?
I did not apply for Kankakee.
But the what I'm saying is now. Then they decided none of these things were minorities, right? So one of my buddies, the same guy, puts together a group, two groups of minority people. And they say, okay, we got to come up with the $50,000. And they're like, we're not coming up with any money. Well, that's the fee. Well, no, we just like want one. well, that's cool. So they didn't apply. Well, now the governor comes out yesterday and starts talking about out of the 200 and some of these things there are, now half of them I know are minorities, or something, or women, or something. Even though women are a majority, I guess they're minorities. Never could quite figure that out. So I said to this guy, I go, "How did these people pay the fees?" He goes, "Not only did they probably not pay the fees, every single one of them has a white person behind it. They're just titled minorities and women."
Oh yeah, that's the big scam.
Yeah.
You just turn around and subcontract.
So now these people are competing against the people who actually had to pay.
To a white-owned company.
It's, I'm talking about even in the application for the license. You can't subcontract there. You got to wait a bit.
I understand, but once you get the license, then you subcontract the work, and so the purpose of the set-aside is voided. It is essentially voided by practice.
So what do you think on Inauguration Day, who's ever there, whoever it is, even Trump has to go back to the White House and go, what the hell have I just got myself into?
Yeah, no kidding.
What would possess... I mean, ask you two guys. Anybody really... I would feel like I was absolutely in jail in the White House. I would have desire to...
That's why I would never want... I mean, when your kids are really young, why don't you run for president, Dad? Yeah, and my first response was, do you guys want to basically be watched every move that you make for 4 to 8 years? Yeah, because and I think Michelle Obama caught a little crap for referring to living in the White House as being kind of like in a jail. But I've always thought of it that way.
Well, Trump was in Chicago yesterday.
I visited the Joliet jail over the weekend. And which is a lot bigger than I thought.
Define visited.
Yeah,
was this a voluntary visit, Russell?
It was a voluntary visit. Oh, okay. I did a tour of it, but I did keep asking if I could see cell 222 on the West Wing. And my wife just hated that I kept asking that.
They didn't de-louse you, did they?
They did not de-louse me. But right. My point was, it was a really big complex. I mean, I think you always think of being in prison as being in a 6x8 all the time. But, you know, they'd walk to a different spot to work, et cetera. It still sucks. But, you know, that's probably a lot like being the president. When you're in Washington, D.C., you're really kind of, if you want to go somewhere, you got to make a big thing about it. Otherwise, you're pretty much just stuck in the same space. And when you go anywhere else, there's always a bubble around you.
Well,
so
Trump was
like in a moving jail.
You guys are probably not aware, but Trump was in Chicago yesterday. And he stayed at Trump, Tower.
I'm in Utah, so I did not know that.
He sat down for like an hour and a half or something with the economic club doing a, on stage one-on-one interview.
I used to be in that. Anyway, he was at Trump Tower, and I think when I was in there, they always did the things at the Palmer House, but he was at the Westin or some one of those places on Michigan Avenue. Mm-hmm. The motorcade to get him, it can't be five blocks, is it? The motorcade to get him one place to the other, that would drive me nuts. Why don't we just hop a cab and go over there? You can't do that, evidently.
Can't call an Uber.
Yeah, call an Uber.
No president has walked anywhere since. Jimmy Carter got out of the car and walked to the White House.
Wow, did you ever see...
He did that at his inauguration.
Did you ever see pictures of Truman walking through all the neighborhoods of Washington with one Secret Service guy and not even a car following him?
No, but I'm not shocked.
Yeah.
I'm really not shocked. And and there were some neighborhoods in D.C. that needed some help back then.
Well, he was 50, 49, 50?
Yeah.
I don't even know what do you suppose D.C. was like back then. I have no clue.
There were bad parts of it and underdeveloped parts of it for a long, long, long time.
I think he might have stayed away from those spots. I don't think he was walking through Inglewood, but you never know.
You don't think he was trying to meet up with his dealer or something?
It wasn't obvious the guy next to him had like an Uzi or something either, the Secret Service guy. Just like a regular guy, just bigger than Truman.
Yeah.
Truman was a tough boy from Missouri. He really wasn't afraid of much, but still.
No, he was not.
Interesting world, Kevin. We miss Mike, but next week we'll get him on Friday. We're trying to figure out Russell. Maybe you have some. Kevin brought up last week that if we end up with these guys from private capital that are going to these universities, essentially trying to put together a professional league with no uncertain terms. And my question to Kevin was, what if somebody doesn't want in? Or wants in, and then 5 years later they go, we don't want any part of this, and they pull out to somebody again. How do you get in and out of the 70 versus the rest that maybe go back to the old model? And the point came up was it's the same as they do in Europe in the soccer stuff. And Mike Murphy's an expert on that, and I thought he might call in this morning. Maybe we'll go grab
him
for it.
Even the people in the model, they have they've proposed a relegation process so that there are tiers. And the tiers of people, it affects your payouts.
Yeah, but
which
also
means once you get relegated, you're kind of doomed to staying there.
Well, I feel like that's what all the West schools should be doing right now, with the Mountain West versus the Pac-12. You know, where a bunch of the they should get 20 teams together and do a relegation model.
Well,
have the Mountain West be the lower level, have the Pac-12 be the higher level, top two, bottom two, and have them shift every year.
Well, I'll ask you guys the question then. Suppose we applied that, and these are the questions I had for Mike. As usual, I dig for these economic questions. I know it's a crazy weakness I have, but suppose you did it in Major League Baseball. Now, this year you say, wow, the Sox suck. we're going to move those guys down. And it looks to me like the Toledo Mudhens kicked ass in AAA. We're going to move them up, which is sort of...
Well, you can't do that.
Well, that's what they do in Europe.
Because, and I don't know who's affiliated with who anymore, but the Toledo Mudhen players play for Detroit.
Okay.
If you think about it, we really do have a relegation system within each team in Major League Baseball.
Okay, that's our system, Russell, which is what we're used to. What Mike has told us is in Europe... You actually do the bottom couple teams.
Yeah, but those teams aren't. But it's not like Manchester United has a AA team that can move up into their league. They're all independent.
But
that's the difference.
Okay, here's my questions. If we were set up the same way, and the AAA was not affiliated, which they are, a lot of ifs. Okay, the Sox have
$142 million payroll. He started last year. They have long-term contracts with people. They have a 50,000-seat stadium. They're out. Now, the next team's in. Now, can the Sox, do they lose all those people to somebody else, or can they? How the hell are they going to still pay them?
No. The teams stay together, but in the relegation model, yeah, you probably have. I mean, I know from some of the things I know about the Sox that if you make the playoffs, there's a certain bump in expected revenue every year, and you can spend that on players. If you get relegated, if you're one of those borderline teams that goes back and forth between relegation. You probably I've been to one of those teams that missed moving up by one spot last year, a couple of years ago when I did the study abroad with the Kelly students. We went to a Millwall game, and Millwall is kind of like the White Sox. Everybody hates them. In fact, their chant is "Everybody hates us and we don't care." But their stadium is nothing like some of the Premier League teams.
Well, that's what I'm saying. So if they move up,
but their goal, their big, you know, my the beginning of the year, my goal for University of Memphis's football was to get that 12th spot that they set aside for the Dowdy teams, and then get their ass completely kicked at Alabama or something in the first round of the playoffs. You know, but at least they were able to play for something, right, which was to make the playoff.
But what I'm, since everything here is all revenue. If the team you're talking about, Mitz is something, they have a really good year, and one of the really big teams has a crummy year, they seat 100,000, these guys seat 30. Right, so you move one up to the other. What does that do to the revenue in the league if you're sharing? Plus, if the team that had the 100 has these long-term contracts to people, how the hell do they pay them when they're not in the league anymore?
Well, ticket revenue is shared between the two teams that are playing.
I know, so the last thing you want to do is lose a 100,000-seat place for a 30.
Okay. Are you going to let me say one thing about this without jumping on me?
Yeah.
Okay. So, first off, revenue is TV.
Okay.
We know that. You know, and each team's revenue is based on the tickets that they, you know, the ticket sales. So, of course, Millwall with their 30,000-seat stadium is going to have a pretty difficult time revenue-wise. You know, the team that Ryan Reynolds and that other guy, I can't ever remember his name, the one they bought. That they've put they've got the ability to put money into and to get them to move up. It's not going to affect the league revenues at all, because you're only talking about, you know what you're talking about? You're talking about the Pittsburgh Pirates, the White Sox, and the A's and the Devil Rays going back and forth. You know, the teams that are at the very low end of the league. And the team that they're going to replace is probably of the same sort of stature. Manchester United is not going to get relegated, ever.
Okay.
The New York Yankees are never going to get relegated if we had a relegation system. But let's say the SEC had some sort of relegation agreement with another league, which they would never do, because none of the teams in the SEC, you know, Vanderbilt is not going to say, "Oh, we're more than happy to get knocked down to the American Athletic Conference if we come in last in the SEC this year, and Tulane comes in first in the American, and they get to go back." And, you know, Tulane was in the SEC one time, and Tulane gets to take our spot. But because of the gigantic disparity in the TV revenue, the SEC and the Big Ten will never participate in what we're talking about. Now, the Pac-12, which got down to two teams, which is now back up to, I think, Hawaii. I think another team got to join recently. But you need eight teams to have an NCAA league. You have to have eight football-playing teams or eight all-sport-paying teams or something like that. If you got 16 teams together out west right now and said the top eight are going to be the Pac-12, the bottom eight in football are going to be the Mountain West Conference, and then for everything else, for all 16 play each other, you'd have kind of a really cool structure. You'd also have something for all the teams to play for. What's going to really mess up college football, and a guy said it on ESPN a couple of weeks ago. He was like, "Well, I don't even know why we're talking about Iowa State right now. You know, because they're 6-0, they're not in the class of, you know, Ohio State, Oregon, Alabama, Georgia. those are the teams that only matter. Those are the teams that we really should be talking about right now. Why would you root for your team if they play in a sport where, you know, that's basically your place? And that's what's going on. NCAA, the actual attendance across the board at NCAA football games is down. It was trending down. It was down 10% between 2010 and 2019, and it has not got, it has not recovered very much. It has not recovered at all, actually, since we came back from COVID. You know, there are only, you know, there are only a dozen games where, you know, the whole stadium feels like it's an earthquake the whole time, and then the rest of them are just pathetic.
Russell,
and
for
the pathetic ones are going to get worse.
Russell, for a period of a decade, the amount of construction on stadiums, the amount of increased seats, is that pretty much stopped? I haven't heard of anybody.
They're modernizing Memphis' stadium, but they're reducing the size.
I mean, Northwestern, yeah, Northwestern,
that's
same way.
That's the new trend.
That's the new trend, is to make it nice and build it to your crowd. A good crowd for a Memphis game, and the best crowds for Memphis games were always when they would get a home game against an SEC team. Yeah, and the Liberty Bowl sat, when I was a kid, it sat 62,000. Now it's down to 50. It's going to be in the 30s after they're done. So they're trying to make them a little nicer, but not necessarily, you know, but, you know, not like the NFL trend where huge and nice and ridiculously expensive.
Well, what is the student? I mean, if you go to at Notre Dame, well, they only had 6,500 people, but there was nobody that didn't go to a game. I mean, Ohio
That's
State's got
to
be.
Ed, I when I went to Memphis, I probably went to, and I was in a fraternity, so I would be, you know, but I worked Saturdays.
Okay.
Most colleges, you know, when you get outside of 30 or 40 universities, it's not like every student is dropping everything that they do and going to a football game. Hell, go to a Northwestern game sometime. They don't have a huge student section there.
Yeah, they're playing in a temporary stadium on the lakefront.
Yeah, even in the temporary stadium.
Stay there.
Yeah.
But they're not.
You know what?
They
should. They should stay there, and they should only if they really wanted to serve their if it wasn't about money, if it was about the team and the university, they would only allow alums to buy tickets, and they continue to play at that lakefront place, which looks so freaking cool. I hope I get a chance to go out.
Well,
there.
Robin was in Michigan a few years before me, when Michigan was a hotbed of anti-war stuff, and she said when the game started, even the weathermen stopped protesting and went to the game.
Yeah, but that's not, I mean, you know, Memphis, I know where the students are still if they have a game on TV, and you know, September weather's nice, that's all awesome. Friday night game when it's cold in November, you could shoot a cannon through the student section and not hit anybody.
Well, how many people at Ohio
you went to a very unique university relative to the average college experience.
Well, Michigan, I think, is the same way. Ohio State's got 40,000
kids
there.
Yeah, but you know what? There are 132 college teams now.
I think Wisconsin's sort of the same way.
Yeah. Of course they are. Yeah. You're talking about all the big but you know what? I love Indiana. But at the end of the first quarter, the game that I went to, they were up 14-0, and all the students started leaving.
Really?
Yeah.
Time to go party.
Hey, I never told you this, Mr. Indiana.
Yeah.
We went to an Indiana game when I was in school. You don't know this guy, one of our buddies, Tim McCauley. He goes, "Oh yeah, well, they used to let you bring a cooler in the game full of beer." It's when they just built the new stadium. Well, it's not new anymore, but I thought that stadium was really nice in terms of seeing the game. You're real close and everything else.
So, it's a great bare bones stadium.
Well, yeah, I mean, there isn't a bad seat in the place. So we get to the gate, and McCauley goes, "You guys go in, I'll hold the tickets." And I go, "Tim, you only got one." So he picks up, you know, he had the stub of the ticket, you threw it on the ground. He picks up like six stubs. So he holds his hand up like he's got seven tickets, right? So six of us wander in and scatter, and he pulls out his one ticket. They didn't care. It wasn't full anyway. The first guy had a cooler.
Yeah.
We sat there and drank beer the whole game, and we had a great. You know, who was still playing was Quinn Buckner. Well, remember that name?
Yeah, I do.
Yeah, he was playing, and
My parents would take me to Memphis State games, and I would not have a ticket, and I just walk through the turnstile.
Yeah, it's just, but you know, the Irish were never like that. The Irish, if you had a
poor Rudy is outside the stadium begging for a ticket.
The White Sox had a deal where,
which I was like, really? At Memphis, he could have just walked in. What the heck is that all about?
The White Sox,
part of that movie perplexes me.
The White Sox, if you were under 2 years old, you got in for free if you sat in somebody's lap. The Irish would charge you if the baby was 3 weeks old. They'd charge when they want a ticket.
Of course they would.
Yeah.
It's a Catholic school. Why weren't they charging, you know, once they were conceived?
All the money's from God. You know, I'm going to say that Russell is a professor, and Kevin, not necessarily an economic professor, but very close to it. This whole thing, isn't it fascinating what's happening? This reminds me of what happened in 73 when they deregulated, like, trucking and airlines and stuff and rail. It's a whole new world.
It's the Wild West, man.
Yeah.
It's like you bring up these things like, well, what if an alumni agrees to give $100,000 to the collective each year, and after year one they go 3-9 and he decides he doesn't want to pay to the collective anymore. Well, the collective is SOL.
Yep. Well, our friend Kevin always brings up interesting. He mentioned that if you have a he was talking about reparations for slavery, and who exactly do you sign the contract with, and how does it happen?
Who pays for it? The Rhodes family came over here in 1898.
Yeah. Well, and now,
you know,
yeah. I mean, well, we didn't show up till 1907, so I'm not so sure.
So I don't really right there.
Anyway, but Kevin, I
got a bolt. I got a meeting.
All right. Okay. Yeah, we'll talk about you when you go.
All right.
go have a good meeting.
Actually, Kevin, it's all about the contract. I mean, these contracts that people are signing for this NIL stuff, are they verb? Is everything like the guy at UNLV, Russell, or is there?
Let me ask you. There's easy outs on both. Yeah, there's usually easy. I mean, he just quit. He just quit football so that he could maintain his year.
Yeah,
and he was not the only one. I saw an ESPN article listing the 20 top people that decided to quit playing this year, and pick it up again next year so they don't lose a year.
Well, what are you picking up? And I'm not asking. I know you don't even, you don't talk to the people at, you know, Indiana to do this, so it's not like
you're going to put your name in the portal and you're going to go somewhere else.
Well, I'm saying if I'm recruited to Sidewash State, and I show up and an assistant coach meets me, and you know there's dollar signs hanging in the air even though we don't mention them, and he says, well, you know, you ought to meet, you know, Kevin. He owns Kevin's Pizza. You know, the biggest pizza joint in town. And Kevin says to me, okay, here's Kevin. Well, you know, if you come by the pizza joint every Sunday night or whatever, we have an autograph signing, and by the way, it's worth, you know, $1,000 a week to you. It's a big pizza joint. Mm-hmm. And I go, okay. Well, now, maybe I'm still in high school, so I can't sign for myself, right, if I'm not 18.
Right.
And all of a sudden I get there, and I'm supposed to be the starting tailback, and guess what? Another guy shows up, and he's better than me. And I show up over at Kevin's on a Sunday night, and he goes, what are you doing here? What do you mean, what am I doing here? I'm here to sign autographs. I want my $1,000. Hey, buddy, you're not starting. I'm not giving you a squat. I mean,
there's a lot of that going on. Michigan State. There's a whole story about the whole Michigan State. I think it was their offensive line was not going to play because they had stopped getting paid. I mean, they were on a road trip.
I remember that. But I'm trying to,
and you're going to see more of that. And as long as you got a rule that you don't lose a year of, you know what? Let's say you're playing for who's having a really. I mean, Oklahoma State is having a very disappointing year. They were slated as maybe making the Big 12 championship game, and they've just completely fallen apart. And they lost a couple of players. Let's say you're a 4 or 5 star recruit. And you're at Oklahoma State, and all of a sudden they're 1-3. If you stop playing for them right now, you don't lose this year of eligibility.
Well, you know that changed,
and that is that. I doubt a whole lot of people had foresight to say, okay, people are going to play 4 games and then not lose their eligibility if their team's not doing as well as they thought, and then they're going to go play for another team next year.
Well, you know that. Where's Kevin when we need him? That changed. It used to be. I think it was the 4th game, Russell, specifically the 4th game or 3rd game. But if you got hurt in a 3rd or 4th game, you could take the rest of the year healing and it didn't count.
Yeah.
But if you played, matter of fact, the Irish did this to somebody. The kicker got hurt or some crap, and they changed it
in 2018 to where you can play in up to four games in a season without losing your red shirt.
Yeah.
I think part of it was because so many players from – yeah, it's just like the bowl games when, you know, like poor Florida State last year. I just want to give Mike Novella a hug. You know, they got shut out of the playoff, which was a crime. You know, they were undefeated. Yep. They did everything expected of them, but except they just don't happen to be in the right conference. That's what it really came down to.
Yep.
And I mean, his team walked out on him, and then they had to go play in a New Year's Day bowl and get their asses kicked with a bunch of backup players. You know, the rule change, I really think, was about allowing players to play in bowl games, but then also having enough players to play in bowl games when teams pull crap like that.
Well, there was a, I think it was an Irish story, got this a long time ago, where the guy was a backup kicker.
Ah.
And somehow or another, somebody ran into the guy, the real kicker, and messed up his leg early in the game. So the guy came in for one play and kicked an extra point and blew his whole year.
Oh,
because it was after the fourth game or something weird like that. So then now,
well,
it's gone from
participate in four games in the season.
Yeah, it was.
But if you played four and it's the fourth game and you're all of a sudden,
yeah.
Really, and if you played four games, and I can understand it from the kid standpoint, but I think it's just Jim Harbaugh is the smartest man in the world because he looked at the wall and he said, you know what? I'm not putting up with this crap anymore, and I got my championship.
Yeah, well, but it's...
I wouldn't want to be a college coach to save my life. Even Anthony Hardaway, in passing, you know, he's like a diehard Memphian. You know, played there. They love him in Memphis. He even made a comment about eventually wanting to move on to the NBA the other day. It was something I never thought we'd hear out of him. But why in the hell wouldn't you want to?
Well, there's always...
With all the uncertainty. You got, you know, players coming and going. They don't even have a full contingent of scholarship players because of the transfer portal this year.
Russell, it's all how you look. When I got out of school, you know, I still was pretty good friends with the guy who ran the dorm. So in the summertime, whenever I wanted to go down and play golf, nobody was ever on the Notre Dame course, especially in the summertime. So I get down there on a Saturday at noon, bring one of my buddies. We'd play 27 holes, go out to the bar, have a burger, crash in the dorm. Next morning we'd play 18, and we'd be home at noon, you know. So it was cool. I never once in the summertime, even in those days, they would say the most stressful job on earth is a college basketball coach. I never was on the course without seeing Digger and a couple of assistant coaches from the football team riding around the golf course in the summertime. It's not as stressful as being a trader with your own money. Let's put it that way. I mean, you're working how many months? Yes, it is way more stressful now. You got all kinds of stuff going with portals and this and that. Now they have the summer camps. It's not like you're not busy, but it's not like they don't have time for a little recreation either. I guarantee you, those guys play way more golf than you and I do. Just saying.
And when they play golf, it's probably with, more often than not, with at least one, but maybe up to three guys, second guessing everything he does in his job.
Not when you're going with the assistant football coaches.
And that's why I think being a coach would be worse. If you're trading with your own money, it's not like you have 100,000 people watching you, second guessing all your decisions.
Well, that's true. Let's do a quick break here. I'll be right back. SP Futures up 375, NASDAQ Futures up 16. Be right back, Stocks and Jocks.
Hello, this is Tom Howell, the Chief. We've talked a lot on the show about risk and suitability, about how your portfolio should match your age, income, and risk appetite. It's been hard for investors to maintain that suitability in the last several years due to a Fed strategy that has driven interest rates to virtually zero. You may have even heard that the Fed was trying to drive conservative investors to a riskier portfolio on purpose, for whatever reason.
Right.
I'm sure you're aware of investors that took some increased risk, such as longer-term fixed income securities, and are now unhappy with that choice. At PTI, we've always stressed total portfolio risk awareness and tried to minimize chasing returns in a tough environment. Well, now it looks like maybe interest rates are moving more towards historical levels. Everyone needs to be aware of what that continued movement might do to your portfolio, both good and bad. We also have a stock market that seems to have stalled, at least for the short term. I think it's time for everyone to take a serious look at their goals, their risks, and their portfolios. Do they match? If not, we can help. We have a signature protected index program. We have ways to hedge against interest risk. We can make that portfolio right for you again. Go to PTISecurities.com or call us right now. The market can change very rapidly. That's PTISecurities.com.
Stocks, jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
You are out of control.
Here, right now. Right here, right now.
Low and open stocks and jocks. I'm Tom Allen. Andrew on the board. S&P futures are up 275. NASDAQ futures up 13. We've been flapping around the flat line here, but we're up a little bit. I don't have individual stocks. I've got ASML is down $31, but still $6.99. Yesterday, the big mover was United Health, which is down like 40-some bucks, which was pretty much the entire move in the Dow. It's, I think the multiplier is like 6.8 or something. Russell probably knows better than me. But over in Europe, we've got a really mixed bag here. DAX down 31.2, FTSE up 66.8, CAC around down 40.5. So that's sort of odd that FTSE and the CAC around are going different directions, but they are. The rock and roll continues over in Asia. Nikkei down 730, it's 1.8%, 39,180. Hang Seng down 31, that's a slow day for them, it's 0.1%. Shanghai up a buck. Let's call that one flat after a huge move up yesterday. Yesterday, Dow was down 324, S&P down 44, NASDAQ down 187. First down day in a while. We came off record highs. Today we're struggling to come back a little bit, but certainly not even much. We're down yesterday. 30-year, 4.01. It's hanging above 401, but down a little bit. The Bund, 2.18, down 4 basis points. Japan down 2 basis points, 0.95. We have oil, which caused the big move yesterday, is it down to 70.65, up 7 cents. We'll talk about that in a second. Brent down 2 cents, 74.23. Natural gas down 5 cents, 243. RBOB unchanged at 203. We've got gold up 17.20, 26.96. We're long. I wish we were longer. Silver up 31 cents, 32.06. Copper up 4 cents, 4.38. We've got foreign exchange. We've got the euro now is under 109, 108.9. It was 111 there for a bit, or high 110s. So the dollar strengthened pretty much in the last couple of weeks. Pound 130, it was up to 132. It doesn't seem like a lot, but a couple of points in one of these things is a big move. Japan continues to get weaker as well. They're up to 149. We got Bitcoin to the moon here, up $1,000, 67,882. What do you got for us? Traffic, weather, sports, Andrew.
All right, it is 7:36 here in Chicago. Just a little bit of sports today. The Blackhawks played and lost last night. They played against the Flames, ended their game 1-3. Over in Chicago, the weather is pretty cold today. We're at 39 degrees currently. We're going to warm up a little bit throughout the day for a high of 56. We're going to have some sun, and that's going to stick around for a little while, and that's pretty nice. Over in Phoenix, they're at 69 degrees. They're going to have some sun as well. They're going to heat up a lot more. They're going up all the way to 98 degrees. And finally, for Chicago traffic, thankfully not much different from our first hour. No major accidents to report, but traffic is heavy on the inbound expressways. And if you're on the outbound, take a look out on the Eisenhower and the Kennedy. Things are building up over there. That is all I got. Back to you, Chief.
You see, Russell, it's a Ripple co-founder, Chris Larson, whoever the hell he is, gave $1 million worth of XRP tokens, wherever the hell they are, to Future Forward, a super PAC that's supporting Vice President Harris. She knows people who have grown up in the innovation economy her whole life. Does she know you? Are you part of the innovation economy, or are you one of the Luddites like me?
I'm a Luddite that understands the other stuff.
Well, there you go. The innovation.
No, I'm at SIBO's risk management conference right now, and had a really nice. I don't remember who it was with, but last night I had a really nice heated discussion about the whole crypto thing. And you know, has other than people trading it or mining it, has anybody really come up with great money making ideas around it? Not particularly.
Well,
other than the price of it goes up,
It's like having a tool.
But it is the blockchain. It's the blockchain technology part of it, because that's what when Cboe launched their Bitcoin futures way back in the day, when I was still there, there was all kinds of talk about all of our trades would be cleared on the blockchain and all these other kind of, and all these other uses that we were going to embrace. It's 10 years later, man. Where is it?
Where's the risk management conference?
And I've got the same opinion about AI. AI I almost equate to just having access to very, 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 very quick access to world book encyclopedia information, and able to put it together a lot quicker than we ever could have in the past. Well, but and again, how do you make money on that?
Well, that's the when was the last
how
time
you
heard
make money with these things?
Yeah, when was the last time you heard part? When was the last time you heard the word cloud? We talked about that for 5 years, right?
Oh, well, they're making a lot. Now that's one they make a lot of money with.
No, I'm saying that was the word you had to say every fourth word.
Right now. Yeah, and but that one actually is legit.
Yeah,
that's why. I mean, Amazon's profits really are running cloud services, not selling us crap.
What where are you for the risk management conference?
We're at Snowbird in Utah.
That's a nice place.
Yeah, I've never been out here before.
It's very dangerous skiing. It's really steep. Avalanche every morning. I hear guns going off and everything. It's steep as hell.
And they even said that apparently the road that we took to get here, the guy driving the van wanted to share all kinds of information, and he said this is the most avalanche stricken road in America.
Dr. J was
and there's a winter storm warning for Thursday, so you think I should get out of here?
Well, it has to get. They dig into the snowpack every day to know the quality of the snowpack.
There's no snow here yet.
No. So. Dr. J was up there with his family. Uh-huh. They had an avalanche, and they buried the entire parking lot and all the rental cars, and they just sent everybody a bus and said, when it melts, we'll go get them. Is it just the Cboe now? When I went to those things, it was a Cboe,
it's just Cboe. I've always felt like that was the correct way to do this conference. It allows the exchange to have full control over who's talking, what products are talked about, et cetera.
Well, it used to be the Board of Trade, the Merck, and the London Stock Exchange, right?
Yeah. There's I've got a little tchotchke 2003 that has the Board of Trade and Cboe on it.
Well, if you went back to 98 or 97, did I ever tell you what happened to me on the way out there? Well, it was at the, what was the original fat farm, La Costa?
I don't know.
It was somewhere by San Diego. And so I was doing some speaking for the Cboe in Las Vegas. So as chairman of the marketing committee, they wanted me to go to this thing too. So I fly out there. And, of course, they had a car for me, the car thing. Well, it wasn't just for me. It turns out there was another person supposed to be in the car. And the car is this limousine. It's got to be 50 feet long with the sofas and the bar and everything in the back, like you'd have for a wedding. Or you'd have like three girls in the back or something like that if you had that kind of money. So we waited for an hour for the other guy, and he never showed up. The other guy was Arthur Levitt. So I would have had a chance to ride the whole hour with just me and the head of the SEC, but he didn't show up. That would have been cool. I don't know if it would have been cool for him, but but I'm
saying that kind of life changing experience for both of you.
If I knew how to make if we had a phone that had a camera, and I was, you should have seen me sitting in the back of this thing with this huge sofa and chairs and bar and all this stuff. I'm there by myself. Anyway, it was the weirdest damn thing. It was basically your Hooker Haven limo, and I'm in it by myself.
You know what? I've been in an Uber that had a stripper pole in it, I beat you. that was like a snowstorm in Oklahoma when I was going down for school, and they were paying the Uber guys like four times the normal rate, and he was like, "Oh God, the only thing I feel safe driving in the snow in is this van." So here you go. But picked up at the airport.
You remember the one in Chicago that had the
stripper pole in the back?
You remember the one in Chicago that had the hot tub where the trunk was?
Yeah, I've seen that one. Yeah.
I don't think we have the body to be in it now, but in those days, maybe.
Yeah. So, hey, I do want to go back to the relegation thing. One thing real quick, because and this is why I think it would actually work in college football. The way that it works is the top four teams they get together for one last match, like 2 and 3 and 1 and 4 play each other or something like that, and they play, you know, at Wembley or what, they play at a giant stadium, and it's almost like a championship game, but it's a championship match between the two of them to figure out which one gets to move up. That would give a lot of teams, a lot of college teams, something to play for. You know, I mean, that's you know, if again, going to the Pac, I'm all fired up about my Pac-12 Mountain West idea this morning, but you get, you know, two of the lower tier teams, or you get four of the lower tier teams, and, you know, the top of the lower tier gets to host one last game, and if they win, they get to move up to the tier. It's a home game. You'd have people show up for that. You'd have people watch that on TV.
I'm
you
curious.
Gotta have something to play. You got to have something to play for, and that's what's ruining that sport is nobody's going to have anything to play for. Nobody wants to go to bowls anymore. It's just it's ruining my favorite sport. That's what I get so upset about.
I'm curious as to how the details. If I have this team and I want to move up, right? So I'm going to assign a bunch of good guys. Two guys get hurt. We don't play as well as we're supposed to. We don't make it. Now I got these long-term contracts that I can't deal with. Or the team that is above me, that is kicked down, has to pay people, and now they're in a totally different TV contract. We're not making as much money. What do they got to do? Can these guys? I mean, it seems like how does the money work between the two levels if you're paying people? In other words, you know, I made the
And they have sharing situations where you know, certain players will be lent out to lower tier teams, and so they do some of those things as well, where you're at, you know. So the salary thing kind of gets a bit blended there. If you get to move up, you will have access to more cash, and you probably can sign a couple of better players.
But there's no obligation that if I'm, and I know the AAA is owned by Major League and so forth. If the Toledo Mudhens weren't, and they were offered the opportunity to move up, does that come with, guys, this 15,000 seat stadium ain't going to cut it. You better have one that holds 40 in the next 2 years, or you're not moving. Are those kinds of stringers attached to the move up or move down?
I don't know, but I know somebody that would know.
Because I mean,
he's not responding to my text.
Well, because I mean,
what I'm doing is so. I learned. I mean, you said Mike's an expert in it, and I don't dispute that for a second. Just because I got sucked into rooting for this second tier team a couple of years ago, and I had one of my best friends. He said he's willing to come on and explain the financials behind it real quick if you want.
Sure.
All right. Let me.
We have 15 minutes.
I got a link. Don't worry about it. All right. We can do that.
Because I think Mike's his army base. Was when he was in Germany, was one of the teams that kept moving up and down or something. That's why he knows quite a bit about it.
Mm-hmm.
Whatever so, city he was right. in.
This gentleman's name is Mike Wilkins, and he lived in the UK for ever. And back in the day, over beers, you know, I basically came up with what is now the college football playoff system.
Okay.
So there.
Well, Rick Tellinger wrote about
it 30 years ago. Yeah, 30 years ago. So.
Yeah, I mean, Rick,
and, I know he did too.
I mean, so. Is he still alive? Yeah. I think he is.
I'm not really sure. Every week somebody dies and I'm surprised they were still alive.
Yeah, well, hopefully while we're waiting for him to pile in, what do you make of some of these numbers lately, and what do you make of the, you know, the Fed seemingly back on the money supply growth kick? I mean, what's that going to do? The dollar's getting stronger.
Well, they got to do something for the short term to keep everybody happy. I'm very concerned about post election.
Yeah, I'm wondering.
Really concerned about it. I mean, I participate in a market preview thing for the Kelley School every year, and I'm having to write it right now, where I have to basically forecast stocks next year. The best, not really even going out on a limb, I can do is, probably an underperforming year. I'm very concerned going into next year. I'm very concerned because both of these guys and one of the other professors at Indiana said this in the meeting. I thought it was just great. He said, basically, it seems like both Trump and Kamala Harris are out there trying to see who can promise to spend more.
Well,
and yeah. that's going to just put, you know, that's going to add fuel to,
well, if they can,
the burning embers that are out there, and it's going to create another round of inflation.
Well, you think they're serious, or is it just they'll say anything for the last 30 days to get a vote?
I'm hoping that they don't do everything they say they're going to do. My buddy Mike is here. So, Mike, we're talking about relegation.
Hi, Mike.
And what we're really curious about, and it's me and Tom Howe, and you can unmute yourself. We wanted to know about the financials for the teams that go up and down. Are there payouts different, et cetera?
First of all, can you hear me?
Yes.
Yeah, we can hear you. There you go. Do you hear my question?
You sound good, actually.
I finally get to say this. Longtime listener, first time caller.
Oh my God, go. You got 10 minutes, Mike. No screwing around, buddy.
All right. So real quick, I'll keep this really short because I actually have a meeting I've got to run to. But so the big thing with relegation and the financials involved is the TV rights. If you are in the Premiership, you obviously get the you get 1/20th of the massive revenue pot that Sky Sports pays every year to televise the Prem all over the UK, and then obviously they sell those rebroadcast rights globally. In the US, it's obviously been sold to NBC, so you're just getting this. You're getting a chunk of that pot. And on the other hand, if you're playing in the Championship or Division, or you know, League One or League Two, the latter two, but you don't even think you're on television, it's a much smaller broadcast rights pool that you're drawing from. So that's the biggest incentive to stay up is just the revenue that you get by being in the Prem.
Well, so if I sign you to a long term contract, and all of a sudden a few guys get hurt and I'm kicked down, is my contract with you null and void, or where am I going to get the money if I drop down?
Yeah, that's we were wondering about the impact on player salaries as well.
Yeah, no, you will see teams have to go, but you'll see teams go bankrupt because they can't meet their payrolls.
So really? Wow.
Players in the English football system, players are bought and sold instead of traded. And they can only be done during set windows. So each time it's kind of like look at it as kind of like renting an apartment. I can pay you £10 million a year to play for my team, but if I am suddenly hard up for cash, I need to sell you. I may be looking at a bit of a fire sale approach, where I sublease you to another team for £8 million just so I can kind of cover my expenses. But it very much becomes and you can only do it during set times of the year. You can't just, there's not a trade deadline like there is in MLB, it's more like they call it a transfer window. It's open, I think, 3 or 4 times a year.
Are the contracts more like free agency, or are they like baseball where you're locked in for life? In other words, if you have a 1-year contract, the guy can't sell you for 2 years, can he?
He can't. Well, he can't sell you for 2 years, but if you're under a 5-year contract to a parent club or to a club, and then get sold to another club for 2 years for a smaller amount, then I, as the parent club, am still on the hook for X.
Okay.
But I'm only getting Y by leasing you out. It's a real balancing act. And I'm not entirely sure of all the nuances of it, but that's kind of in a nutshell, the way that it works.
Can any guys have a no-trade agreement like you can in Major League Baseball?
I don't believe you can. I'm pretty sure.
But anybody that reaches that status, you don't want them playing for somebody else anyway.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
You know,
those are your untouchables. Yeah.
And part of the rent, part of the renting out players, there's some of this in Ted Lasso, where one of their best players is actually with a top tier team, but he's relatively new, and they want to get him playing experience. So they basically lent him out to a lower tier team, kind of like the AAA thing in baseball, but they're two separate teams,
mm-hmm.
and they compete with each other sometimes. I mean, you'll end up playing the team that that originally signed you if you're being lent out to another team.
It's a different system, and it kind of gets you to the same place, doesn't it?
It
kind of does in a roundabout way. Yeah, yeah.
Well, so you can't. Is it illegal? Illegal. Against the rules to trade a player for a player?
It just
you just do a swap and a buy and a sell?
A block trade, I guess. I guess it could, but I can't think of a time when that's
well, it seems like if I have, well, I don't know much about soccer, but if one of my midfielders gets hurt and I got two extra defensemen and one of your defensemen gets hurt and you need a defenseman, I need a midfielder, what I pay $100,000 for your guy and you pay $100,000 for my guy and they switch?
I could do that, or I could also, the way that the teams work is they carry it, they operate under an academy system. So they've got a whole, like their minor league, you're all attached to the club, but you play for like a second team or an under 23s or an under 21s or an under 19s. What you'll typically do in that type of situation where you have somebody who, if your bench is completely depleted, you'll bring somebody up from the, if you're not within the transfer window where you can sign somebody or swap somebody, you'll go out and you'll pull somebody off your under 23s.
So that's almost like Major League Baseball then.
Exactly, yeah. It is like that, only it's all within the same, it's more of like just a set of club or a set of clubs or a set of teams within a single club as opposed to different clubs under a parent organization.
So one of the big questions for me, there's a million big questions here. where does Oxford fit into this? Nowhere? They just have a club team?
No, so Oxford United has a, I think they play in they're either in the championship or one level below that. And,
But I mean, the colleges are not like here. If you're a real good soccer player,
he's asking about the university.
Yeah, I'm talking about the university.
Yeah. So the university will have it. University clubs are a whole separate animal. Generally, a club is attached to a town or a neighborhood or a community organization. Like for example, my team is Arsenal. Arsenal's founding team way back in the 1800s made up of guys who worked in the Woolwich Arsenal. Hence the name.
There you go.
Yeah. Yeah, but so for universities, it's a whole they have a whole different system. They have university clubs that will generally play other university clubs. But sorry, I got confused.
So it's like the Notre Dame rugby club. It's not like the Notre Dame football team.
Exactly. Okay. That is exactly how it works. Yeah. No. And as a rugby guy, I definitely appreciate the reference.
Where did you play?
I played at Canisius College in Buffalo, New York.
Really?
And then I played for a couple of years.
So you played against Jack Carroll and all those teams.
We played a lot of the other Jesuit schools like John Carroll. We played against a lot of the other smaller Northeastern colleges like Duquesne and Manhattan and Iona and some of the other schools that were actually for big sports were in our conference.
Did you do it afterward? One of my buddies from Notre Dame played for the Chicago Lions forever afterward.
No, I never had the talent level to. I was more in it for the knocking back beers than for the competition. But no, I never played.
Well, he was a real high end kicker, so they wanted him.
Really?
Yeah, he was a kicker, and what's the first guy first guy in the scrum that's supposed to kick the ball out? He's a hooker. The hooker,
scrum half.
The what?
Scrum half. Well, so he played up front. So he was a hooker. Yeah.
He was that guy, and he was a kicker. So even though he wasn't the biggest and fastest and strongest, they wanted him because he was skilled.
Yeah, exactly. And that's the thing is you've got two guys. You have two types of guys out there. You got your speedsters. And you got your brutes. It's kind of neither.
But I
was in it for the.
So you had a good time. Yeah, it was girls, did you guys used to? These guys went to Ireland a couple of years during spring break. Did you ever do that?
Never got to do an international tour. We didn't have the budget. Our budget was based on how many people we could get to come to our house parties.
Remember him telling me that he goes here was all the guys that basically couldn't make the football team, right? So it was essentially like a football game, even though it was rugby. He says you go over to Ireland. Because nobody hits anybody, we lost every game. Because they were so fast, as soon as you went to hit somebody, you got to give the ball to somebody else.
Yeah, you got
to
tackle them, and they're already two yards past you.
Yeah,
it is a whole different standard of play in the
this way they did this. They do this in this soccer stuff. Has this been a 50-year evolution, or has it been exactly like this for a long time?
I think I would say the television rights were a different animal.
Okay.
Earlier. So I think the stakes have gotten a lot higher, but historically, that's the way as far as I know, that's the way the transfer system's always worked.
So the low end team, even though they're never going to win anything, they get the same piece. It's like the Kansas City, the Royals still get the same chunk of the national TV as the Yankees, even though, well, this year they almost won something.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. Bad team for this year, but yeah.
Let's use the White Sox. We'll use mine and Russell's team. The White Sox get the.
Well, you know what I can't find, and it's somewhere. I mean, I try, for the show, I keep trying to dig out all this crap. I can never find. Going back to when I was a Cubs season ticket holder, in a couple of years, I got rid of all the good players in the middle of the year, and I never got a 30% discount on my tickets. I can find the revenue, the major league salaries to start the year. I can't find where they are to end the year. I mean, the Sox started out at $142 million. I'm positive they didn't end the year there.
Yeah.
I know they didn't.
But I mean, there's no list that says they ended the year at 70 or 80 or something. You can't really get that. But did you you may know this, but if not, maybe you pick up a little piece of information, listen, by calling in, that five of the playoff teams were in the bottom nine in payroll.
I did not know that.
I was aware that some of the smaller market were in.
Can you name them?
Oh, gosh. I don't even know who. I know the Royals and the Yankees were in the playoffs. I know the Mets and the Dodgers were.
Well, it's interesting.
Which they're not two of them. Milwaukee was probably one of them.
Yep.
I don't
Well,
really
if you look at – I was so stunned when playoffs, I saw this thing. The Mets, the Dodgers, and the Yankees are grouped three people like above $300 million. Then you like drop down 40 or 50 mil. Then there's a chunk of teams there. Then you drop down like another 20, and there's a whole bunch of teams there.
Yeah.
And then there's stuff at the bottom. But Kansas City, the lowest one, I think, was Cleveland. Cleveland, Detroit.
I could totally see that, and I think that's been a thing.
Cleveland.
My buddy Mike has to go make a meeting, so we're going to let him go.
All right, Mike, take care. Thank you.
It's been an honor and a pleasure.
We'll have you back, bud.
We want to talk UK sports.
Okay.
yeah, Russell, UK sports expert. Yay!
Russell, have a great day.
Yep, Russell. I think it was Detroit, Cleveland, Milwaukee, Kansas City, and who the hell was the other one? There was another one that was there too.
It's
came from the South. I mean, I forget what it was, but there were five of them, and I was surprised. You know,
not the Braves.
No, because
Braves are big. I don't even know who made the playoffs.
But so the one at the bottom is Oakland. They're only like $60 million.
Yeah.
They got nothing.
Hey, did you see that Tampa's going to play in Oakland?
Really?
Yeah, the roof got ripped off their stadium, and they're going to play in Oakland next year. I love that.
I think that's
absolutely wonderful.
Did you realize that the for the hurricane they had all the first responders were staging in that?
Oh, I know. That's exactly where they had them.
Well, who's the guy who looked up and says, "We can't stage here. That thing's fair." Somebody got him out of there before it got wrecked.
I was at a preseason football game when the Falcons used to play in the Georgia Dome, and they had a similar top. And there was a huge thunderstorm going on outside. I mean, you could, when the lightning struck, you could the roof turned blue.
Whoa.
And it was waving in the wind and everything. And later that evening, it got a giant hole ripped in it. So it's not like that hadn't happened before.
Well, remember the Hump Dome?
Yeah,
they had the ice storm and it ripped. Yeah. And that thing was, for those that don't know, it had a fabric roof that actually, because of the air, the pressure in the place, they kept it a couple atmosphere more than outside. It was like a balloon. But if you would have opened up every door in the place simultaneously, the roof would have dropped. But they had all these beams running across. It would have dropped on the beams, and it would have been. You could have refloated it up by closing the doors. But when they had this ice storm, it ripped through, and they couldn't play there. Remember Minnesota? I don't know where they played.
Yeah. I do remember that now. I do.
So they're not going to fix this place?
No. They are. It's just going to take a while.
Like more than a year?
Well, what's your priority on fixing things?
Funny you should mention it. Tomorrow, if you want to listen in. By the way, if you want to sneak in, second hour tomorrow, one of my best friends from high school, a civil engineer forever. He did all the some of the surveying stuff for Schomburg and stuff. He's a retired civil engineer. He used to work for an outfit here in Chicago, Concert Townsend, that actually did the subways way back. That's how far.
Oh, wow.
And he's retired now. I'm going to talk to him tomorrow about the hurricane stuff and the stuff in North Carolina. How many variables are there? If you walk in and say, okay, we got to fix stuff. Okay, there's 10 roads out. There's 5 causeways out. There's lead times on everything. If it's steel, it's probably a year and a half. I mean, how do you figure out what you do first and what do you have? I mean, you might want to do this first, but you might not have the material to do that. You might have it for something else. And I think if you want to call in tomorrow, I'd love it because Dan's not going to be here. Dan Janine will be on a plane. So, and I think you would have better questions than me. But how you go about, God, I'd really love to to fix the interstate, but hell, that's an eight-month project, and we need this, and we can't get it till then. Yet this causeway, it's concrete. The concrete guy's still open, even though the causeway is not a priority. We can fix that this week because we got the stuff. I mean, it's got to be in an amazing, I'm going to say, 14-column piece of paper. I'll say an ex, you know, it's got to be some kind of a real mathematical thing how you go about doing this. Well, you got to fix this bridge first. Yeah, but the beam I need is a year and a half out. Okay, well, I guess we can't build a bridge, you know, type of thing.
Yeah.
It's got to be fascinating. So I'm saying, if you want to pile in, you can help out tomorrow. If you can't, you can't, but I'd love it if you did.
I'll check the schedule out here. Tomorrow, Thursday's the big day for the conference, but I think it's early enough that I won't have anything going on.
By the way,
heck, it's only 7 out here right now.
By the way, I had dinner at my brother's on Sunday, like I do most of the time, and my nephew's two lovely little daughters, age 2 and age 7, after our lady was on last Wednesday, and what people are going through at that age in terms of money, and are you ever going to be able to get a house? I mean, how much is your student loans? I kept looking at these two young girls going, God, it's going to be worse for you than it was for that lady, if the way things are going.
Oh, yeah.
That's all I kept thinking. I'm thinking, how much does Uncle Tom have to make to put in a bank so these kids can go to school? I mean, what's it going to be, $1 million?
No, what you do is you tie their right hand. Are they girls or boys?
Girls, but you know that you can't
make them lefties and throw them into softball.
I was mentioning the older one. Say, what are you doing? Well, I'm taking tumbling and ballet, and I'm going, that's not going to cut it. But I don't want to say that. I'm just an uncle, you know, great uncle.
Of course.
Anyway. Russell, thank you very much. I'd love to have a good time at the conference.
I'm gonna be honest. Mike's been dying to get on here for years.
I tell you what, he's great. S&P futures up 3.
He is.
NASDAQ futures up 24. Back tomorrow, Stacks and Jacks.
That's all, folks.